Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday morning. It is the 23rd of April, and we are very happy that you are with us on this day. We have a lot to talk about. We have a great, great group to talk about the things that are going on in our world. It's very complex. It can be just exhausting in trying to figure out everything, which is why we try to take a few moments, 2 hours out of our day and talk about it, try to make sense of it and come to some, understanding. And maybe we let you share your thoughts, we share our thoughts, and at the end of the time, maybe we all come out a little bit more educated, or at least a little bit more thoughtful as to what is going on in our world. That's the hope. Do we achieve that? I don't know, but we give it a shot. So here we are on this morning, and I want to introduce our group to you. I do want to tell you about something that happens 1 week from today, and that is that we are bringing this program, the entire program, we are bringing to, well, actually, the panel part of the program, we are bringing to Hardwick College's Shinneman Chapel House, and we're doing this in partnership with the Hardwick Institute of Public Service. This is a wonderful, incredible institute that brings students into, everyone always talks about, we're not teaching our children civics. We're not teaching them about government and democracy. Well, all of these kids are doing just that in college, and they are learning all kinds of really impressive things. They go through meaningfully engaging in democracy through three supporting areas, which is local and state government, civic engagement, as well as legal education. We thought, what better day to bring the show to the Institute than on the 100th day of the second administration of Donald J. Trump? So that's exactly what we're doing. We're bringing our show, the panel, to Hardwick. We have three wonderful... Laurel Elder is a regular guest in our program. She's professor and chair of political science at Hardwick College and co-director of the Institute, Hardwick Institute of Public Service. Two of her colleagues, Zachary McKenney and Matthew Schick, will also join us on the show on Wednesday morning. We also will have six students who are working hard and have thoughts on all of these issues, and we'll be talking to the students. So it will be quite an event taking place 1 week from this morning. If you'd like to be in the room where it happens, all you have to do is go to WAMC.org. We have ticket information there. It's a $50 pledge to WAMC, and you can come and join us in Oneonta. We would love to have you. We're having people from the community, we're having people from the college, and we would love to welcome our listeners to the show as well. So WAMC on the road, the roundtable live in Oneonta can be yours for a pledge of $50 per ticket to WAMC. And all you have to do is go to WAMC.org and just click on the link and we'll take you there. So it's going to be a lot of fun. We welcome you and we hope that you will be able to join us one way or another. It'll be on the radio too, so that's another way to listen. But we would love to have you in the room and be able to ask these students and talk to these students who are really great. We had a group of students last fall from different kids, but from the same institute, and they're really brilliant. They're amazing kids. So we look forward to talking to them about this stuff. They are, after all, the ones who inherit the mess that we are making. All right. Let me introduce the group to you. Teresa Bourgeois is here, public policy and communications expert. She has a little bit of a cold, so she's behind a mask. So if she sounds a little bit muffled, it's not because we have a gag in her mouth. It's because she's being responsible and wearing a mask. And good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Well, I'm doing all right.
All right. Good to have you here, and we thank you very much for being with us. We also welcome Jay Jochnowitz to the program, editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer at the Times Union. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
I'm well. I still have not found Christy Noem's pocketbook, but I'm hopeful.
No. Yeah. And you think, you know, you use the Find My app, and you think, oh, you know, it's gonna suddenly bring us right into $3,000 a passport and a phone.
But yeah. It would be nice. You know, what I worry about, you know, sincerely on that, is that she had, like, you know, her little password book in there. I'm guessing a lot of people in the Trump administration are a little low-tech these days, so she's probably got a little notepad that said, you know, here's my password to the Homeland Security system, here's my Oh, and Pete loaned me the nuclear codes just because, you know, it's so fun have them.
And people have been saying, well, $3,000 seemed like a lot of money to be carrying at any one given time, and I was just thinking to myself, oh, my God, I hope she wasn't getting ready to buy a puppy.
Or it was a go bag.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the Homeland Security Director.
Yeah, I don't want any of those things happening. Karen Riedel is with us. She is Associate Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College, President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. That's cool. Karen Riedel, good morning. How are you? I'm just going to take your mic right there.
Good morning. So glad to be here, and I'm feeling much better now after your announcement about the efforts with students. And one of the silver linings of the current situation to me is this re-emergence of interest in political science. I certainly see it in my students, and also see their interest in getting offline and back into the room and engage with their peers. About political science and politics, so I'm really excited about this effort.
And are you impressed? I mean, obviously, I'm asking to generalize about all of your students, and that's impossible to do. But are you generally impressed by what you see and the level of interest in what is going on amongst your students?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. And that's they are keenly aware of what is going on. They're looking for answers. They're looking for explanations. They know they don't understand what's going on. And I see it across the board. It's like I work at a community college, Dutchess Community College, as you said. So where we have, you know, a truly diverse student body, and I don't just mean in the usual sense, but in terms of experience and understanding and very different homes and values. And across the board, people want to know and want to understand more. So, yes, I am actually I'm quite optimistic.
Good. We'll take any sense of optimism that anyone has. So that is great. We welcome you, Dr. Karen Riedel, to the program. We welcome you as well, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we'd love to hear from you on the topics that we discuss this morning. All right, let's get to our list. And it's always one of those where to begin things in the current news cycle, because there's just so much going on. And but let's say that let's go with this, that Donald Trump says that he won't fire Jerome Powell, but the battle over the Fed may not be over. So Donald Trump says the guy's a loser, and then the market goes nuts 2 days ago. And when I go nuts, I mean it fell horribly. And then yesterday the president did something that was odd and rather unique in his circumstances. He didn't say anything. And then oddly, the market then went up. And then he said finally, after this great concern as to what exactly was going to happen when it comes to the Federal Reserve, he said that he had no intention of ousting Jerome Powell, the Federal Reserve chair, but still threatening the central bank and their independence, that continues. But the actual job of Colin Powell, good Lord, my apologies, Jerome Powell, certainly seems to be, at least for the moment, this can change on a dime, but for the moment seems to be somewhat secure. And as a result, markets surge after the Trump announcement. While I think we take all of this as good news that the market is up, it once again just looks at the turbulence of the markets. It looks at the up and down and the up and down and the overall chaos that seems to have been caused by this, which still allows us to think there are many questions as to the state of our economy and where we stand. Karen, would you like to begin?
Sure. It's chaos. I think you nailed it. And a good day in the markets isn't a good sign for our future. It's not a good sign for the independence of the Federal Reserve. It's been attacked openly, and it won't end there. And it would be a really bad thing for our democracy if politicians gained influence over monetary policy again. We know how it works. We've seen it in other countries where the influence of politicians over monetary policy has led to no good outcomes. So it's I'm troubled.
Jay,
yeah, I would agree with that. The in Trump 1.0, we saw a lot of attempts by Donald Trump to intimidate the Fed into keeping interest rates low and to lower them even more when they were approaching zero or negative territory. And what Trump wants Jerome Powell to do, and he wants the Fed to do now, is pretty clear. He wants them to try to compensate for his mistake. His mistaken policies on tariffs, and if he can stimulate, you know, growth in the United States artificially through lower interest rates, then we end up with that. But you know, this is all a tapestry, and I trust the Fed to have a much better handle on this than Donald Trump, who just operates from day to day on what Fox News is saying and what the blogosphere is saying and what everybody is criticizing or not criticizing and so forth. That if you, he's also talking, and I realize this isn't part of that discussion, but I think it's related in terms of what I'm talking about. He's talking about $5,000 checks to Americans. Flooding the market unnecessarily, flooding the economy unnecessarily again with money like we did in COVID for perhaps a good reason. But what we end up with is low interest rates, a lot of cash in the market. We're going to end up with another inflationary situation. And then he's going to want someone else to paper over that mistake. And who knows what that's going to be. And no wonder the markets were relieved to hear, all right, maybe I'm not going to fire the guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Teresa.
Yeah, I think this is rhetorical blame shifting, right? That he is rattling the markets seriously with the chaos around his tariff proposals. At the same time, these deep cuts, the Trump Doge, you know, Musk, Vance, deep cuts are, you know, rattling the economy, they're causing great distraction and concern, whether it's for our medical research or any of a range of things. And this, it's chaos, but it's really, really costly chaos, both in the short and the long term. I mean, that's what I worry about because, you know, somebody is making money in these dramatic shifts in the market, right? But more people are losing money. People who know how to play the markets, they're making the money. But a lot of people, average working people, are losing money. And those are the people he said he cared about their economy. And a lot of what he's doing is hurting their economy, the average working people's economy. And I think that that this, it's, you know, it's erratic, it's senseless. And it causes businesses to go elsewhere. It's going to cause other countries, you know, to be less and less wanting to invest in the dollar, right? That's to me, What's the long-term financial impact? I'd love to hear some people who are listening who understand, you know, over time, you know, the financial folks that might be listening, over time, what's the long-term impact of this financially erratic behavior? And also, I mean, he flat out lied. I mean, in that one of the quotes, he said, I don't want to talk about that because I have no intention of firing, none whatsoever. And then he said, never did. I mean, you just, it's all on tape. I mean, you just, you know, play the tape. So what's the cost of that? I think it's high.
We're going to let that question just hold in the air for a moment while we take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. And not that we're going to answer it, but
maybe one of our listeners will try.
Yeah, that's right. We'll figure that out right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our program this morning. Christian McBride and Edgar Meyer, their album, But Who's Gonna Play the Melody? That's what we're listening to this morning. There's a playlist posted online, wamc.org. We're talking about the president saying yesterday he has no intention of ousting Jerome Powell. Mixed signals there, because he called him a loser and said that he should lose his job the day before. And I don't know, oddly enough, people thought maybe that was going to indicate something that he wanted to do. He certainly had led us down that path. The Mr. Trump has done this before with Powell.
He has practiced doing this, yeah.
Yes, in the first term, and then he began berating him again in the second term, urging the Fed to lower borrowing rates. But the economic circumstances today are drastically different than those of 2019, setting the stage for a more intense showdown before the central bank and Mr. Trump. While Mr. Trump said he has no intention of firing Mr. Powell, despite having lambasted him over several days, calling the federal chair a major loser and saying his termination cannot come fast enough. But the clash between Trump and the Fed is likely to linger. On one side is a Fed now much more hesitant to reduce borrowing costs because of fears that the broad-based tariffs Mr. Trump has announced on virtually all U.S. trading partners will reignite inflation and slow economic growth. And the other side is a White House wanting immediate relief and taking steps to infringe on the central bank's longstanding political independence. Teresa, I had to interrupt to go to a break. I didn't know if you had anything else you wanted to add.
Well, the only other thing I would say is that I try to listen to a lot of conservative radio and Fox and such, and you really hear them echoing this extensively. And again, part of the blame shifting. And so the public who listens to that all the time have the sense that the rattling in the economy is not Trump's fault. It's the Fed's fault. And I think that's, you know, an intentional on Trump's part. But it's a distraction, but it's really a very, very costly one, because what it does is, you know, rattles the situation in the family, you know, average working families in ways that they don't necessarily link back to this discussion. But it does cause economic disruption. And doing it at the same time when they're quietly behind the scenes putting together budgets, which, you know, I think that needs a lot of attention, because the other thing that was talked about yesterday is they hope to have a final deal on the budget by July 4th. And there's some pretty draconian cuts coming. And I think this is all part of a package that's going to create economic hardship for a lot of people.
So meanwhile, the other story here is the fact that Trump is saying that China tariffs will come down substantially, which is hinting at a potential U-turn. I try to make these things not sound like as an indictment, but then when you read them, it's like, I don't know how else you're going to take this. But here it goes. He said, I think it should come down substantially, but it won't be zero.
Right.
Okay. So I don't know what exactly that means, but there you go.
So they weren't zero before either.
No.
So so what does that mean? It's going to be zero from where we started, or
they'll
zero?
They'll come down substantially. And what are we? We were at 145. We were at 125, and then we added another 20%. So Trump's remarks made at the White House on Tuesday appear to mark a rhetorical climb down after weeks of tough posturing and basically tit-for-tat retaliation that sent tariffs on China to a staggering 145%. 145% is very high, Trump said. But it won't be that high. And he said this in a question and answer session with reporters in the Oval Office. It won't be anywhere near that high. It'll come down substantially. But it won't come down to zero.
That great caving sound.
You're a businessman. I mean, the stock market aside, the point of all this was to bring American manufacturing back home and to have a quote-unquote fair trade policy. But bringing American manufacturing back home, this which a lot of people say is not what we think it is. It's not what we're not going to have the assembly lines of the 1950s where people were taking home really good incomes. We're going to have robots are coming, automated factories are coming if any of this comes back. But how in God's name do you as a businessman make a decision about a major long-term investment like relocating a factory in the United States from wherever it was, based on a president who can't make up his mind from day to day what it is he's doing and is constantly reinforced by a media sphere, a politosphere that just simply says he's brilliant, he's playing 7D chess, we don't know what it is, but man, he's just great. This is chaos. That's exactly exactly the word. You know, all this from day to day is just built on whatever they feel the American public is going to buy, you know, from one day to the next. I mean, we started out, I mean, this is not directly relevant, but it is in a sense. You know, we started out with $1 trillion in cuts, or I think $2 trillion in cuts. Then we went to $1 trillion. Then we went to $2 billion, and the real number was $200 million. Wall Street must just be looking this and at this, and investors, companies must be looking at this and thinking, God, this can't end soon enough.
I just think of all of the journalists over the years, all the generations for decades and decades who have been sitting at presidential news conferences and just thinking to themselves, God, I wonder what he's really thinking. Like, I wonder what's going on. And Trump tells us, and now we know that we probably don't want to know. Like, he just says, either this morning, just a few minutes ago, apparently said, maybe half. Could be less, could be more, half. And that's just like, that's not, if anyone, that's a thought you have, and maybe it's something that it was in a discussion, but it's not a plan. And what do you do with that information? Because the markets, unfortunately, the markets then react to that or to other statements that they're making.
Right. And I mean, every time I hear people now just talking, well, he's a great negotiator. I think that's just sane washing. I mean, at this point, it's sane washing, is trying to explain away the erratic behavior by Trump, and that the administration doesn't seem to have a comprehensive, coherent trade policy. They don't seem to be confronting this with the level of seriousness that it requires. And so what's the implications for the costly chaos? Well, what's the implications for farmers? How do farmers plan, right? How do they, in the last time he did this, in the last administration, the taxpayers, you know, there was a $63 billion bailout to the agriculture community. because it hurt farmers so much. So what's it going to be this time? How do auto manufacturers plan? And then what happens to the customers? What happens to the customers for our agriculture products that we export all around the world? Because there's such instability, they're just going to find other markets. And once you find another market, I mean, I listened to a couple of interviews with farmers saying, you know, we work decades to try to build these relationships, to build this, you know, customer flow. And once you disrupt that, they go somewhere else. That's hard to get them back. And that has a ripple effect. And I just think, again, it's the tariff issue that's disrupting the economy. At the same time, these indiscriminate cuts and probably illegal cuts in research and other also, you know, programs across the board, education, so on and so forth, that's disrupting the economy. It's chaos and it's dangerous and it's hard on the average working family.
Meanwhile, the Trump shift in tone also went viral on the Chinese internet. On Wednesday, the hashtag Trump chickened out was trending as a top topic on social media, racking up more than 150 million views.
Speaking of chicken, can we talk about his comment on the cost of eggs going down to the lowest ever?
The lowest ever?
The other day?
I don't buy eggs, so.
Well, you have chickens.
I have chickens.
Yes.
And the cost of eggs has been constant for me, you know, zero plus feed.
Yeah, right.
The gas prices are $1.50 a gallon, he said. I think he said $1.50, $1.58, something like that. And that the egg prices are down. I'm sorry, that's a little distracting for what you were talking about. But when you said chicken, I just like.
You know what? If we just say that it's part of our economic conversation, Teresa, we can get away with it.
I was like, what did why didn't any reporter say what? You know, they're not down. He said they were down 75%. Everybody, you know, it was Biden driving these egg prices up, and they blame me in the first day. All they talk about eggs. And look at now, this was around the whole Easter egg roll thing, which.
But Teresa, the complexities you just laid out, all the considerations that should go into government, into international politics, into trade policy. None of that is evident in anything that we've seen. My 11-year-old son, he recently said that he can, in chess, he's an avid chess player, and he said, I can think two steps ahead, and as a good mother, I crushed his dreams right there and then, and I explained to him that thinking two steps ahead means that if you consider all your steps, and then you consider what your opponent might be doing for each step that you're taking, and then if you really want to think the next step ahead is for each one of the possibilities, you need to think, what would I be doing? And that is what politics is, especially in the international sphere and in trade policies. And we're seeing none of that. I cannot fathom that this administration assumed that China wouldn't react the way it did, that it would come immediately to the negotiation table. That's what I'm assuming the assumption was. If we impose 125% tariff, they will come in running to the negotiation table, and they will. And there is a lot to discuss when it comes to our trade relations with China. There are a lot of issues that need to be, could be addressed that would make global trade better, for lack of better words. But this isn't happening because this kind of predatory approach to international relations, China is simply, they don't have to come to the table that way.
Well, and on this topic, you know, it appears that he has long, long-standing views about tariffs, right? But as someone who are experts in this, not me, that's for sure, say the problem is his views are stuck in the 80s mindset of what the global configuration is. And the global configuration is not what it was in the 80s. And I think that the Michigan car industry is a perfect example of that, where there is back and forth over the border between Michigan and Canada a constant flow of car parts and, you know, auto parts to assemble a car. And that was working. But now that's all disrupted. And I know I still can't get over attacking Canada. I mean, at least he's calmed down on that for a little bit. But
President said that prices for eggs are getting too low.
Too low, yeah.
He praised Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins for doing a great job and then asserted that egg prices are down 87%, but nobody talks about that. You can have all the eggs you watch. You're going to have too many eggs. In fact, if anything, the prices are getting too low. So I just want to let you know the prices are down, the president said on Friday. This was after the swearing in of Dr. Mehmet Oz, where his Dr. Oz's granddaughter fainted as Trump was speaking. But that's beside the point. But it is true.
Listen to that statement. If Joe Biden had said that, there would be 3 days of nonstop barrage of discussion about that.
About how out of touch he is.
Out of touch he is.
With the concerns of ordinary Americans and the budgets of ordinary Americans.
Now, with that said, I will, according to the average wholesale price of eggs was $3.13, a slight uptick from the previous week. According to the Department of Agriculture, the prices have dropped since February, and retail prices are also beginning to drop. Price levels to the consumer have eased considerably from early year highs, but remain at levels not yet conducive. More normal purchase needs, according to the Agriculture Department, which I believe was your point.
That's my point. And if, as I say, if other people had said that, but him, oh, well, it's just how he is. And gas at $1.50 a gallon, it's double that at least.
Not what I paid for.
It's like $3.09, $3.10.
I don't know if that's what a wholesale price works out to, but I can
at the pump, that's
say with
not
confidence
what it is.
That's not what it is. It was close to $3. I think I actually got a decent buy because I was in a low-tax county, so I got, you know, $2.85. Whee! That's not. I could have done that 3 months ago too.
But it's it's as with attacking Paul, it's creating your own reality. But his words matter and facts matter, and even though he is doesn't deal in facts, the rest of the world does, and his lack of doing that has implications.
Mike, I owe you a break, right? I owe you a break. Yes. Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this. You know, I forget that people listen to the show. And I have no recollection of it. So yesterday I was mangling a sentence, and I said I'm just taking all of this cold medicine. And I feel like my brain is just, sort of sent out to the cleaners. And so yesterday afternoon, my wife went to the pharmacy to pick up new cold medicine for me. And the pharmacist and the tech there said, What is that the medicine Joe's taking? And my wife said yes. And she said, tell him that that has nothing to do with him being an idiot and not being able to talk.
Ow.
And if you're listening this morning,
yeah.
Joe says hello.
And I believe it was, he's just getting old. So this comes to me in a minute ago when I had to turn to Mike and I was like, so or do I owe you a break? Because I had no recollection of whether we had taken a break or not. It's fine, right? It's all
news.
Fine.
It's saved watching, Joe. Blame it on the medicine.
Just, yeah, that's right. Just I'm still going to
Trumpify it. Blame it on somebody else.
I'm still going to blame it on the or I could just blame it on the cold, right? You could just blame it on the...
Anything but your own self.
There you go.
That's what we're modeling Trump now. Blame it on anything or anybody but your own self.
I always worry that when people, hosts are too much in control of the commercial breaks, like they're on top of everything, that they're really not paying attention to what people are saying. So I think you're paying more attention to what's going on.
Thank you.
And it's so riveting what we're saying.
I believe both can be true. Let's go to letters. We go to
Linda. Throwing you a bone here.
Thank you.
Try to be nice.
We go to Linda, who says Trump is an unserious man. He has an insatiable lust for power. He absolutely loves that with one tweet he makes that he can upend the stock markets and send them plummeting. Then the next day he can tweet another stating that he has no intention to fire Powell and the markets then stabilize somewhat. To him, it is all a game. Maybe we should just ignore the tweets. He's trying to gaslight the whole world and putting every part of the economy in chaos, and he is loving it. That from Linda.
I'm for paying a lot more attention to the details of what they're doing around the budget and things like that. I know you can't really ignore the tweets because they do move the markets. But I think a lot more attention needs to be paid to the substance of what they're trying to codify now, because that has a long-term impact on people's lives.
This one from John: Trump isn't a great negotiator, he's a bully. And then written in the form of a haiku, it isn't a haiku, but it says Trump is an abusive bully. That's how he's able to get what he wants: bullying and thuggish extortion. JD checks in. Two words come to mind on the subject: market manipulation.
Yeah, that's an open question that the Democrats have said they want to explore. Whether some of the big volatility that happened was not just an accident, that there might have been inside information. I tend to not doubt that there was. Fortunes could have been made overnight.
And then he was signaling in some cases, right? Yeah. And who's making money on the way up and who's making money on the way down? Yeah. Not me, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Then we go to David, who says, I want to try to talk to my MAGA family about what's happening with tariffs and deportations, and they believe something completely different from the facts. How can we survive this? Well, that's a question we've been asking for a long time, right, of how we come to some common ground.
Yeah, and you like to think his survival instincts are going to kick in, that the people around him will say, you just can't. This is just not working, sir. Everybody has to say sir at some point in the conversation. That you like to hope that ultimately he's not going to let it completely tank.
But
that maybe that's what's going on with China right now. But who knows? I mean, he's so volatile.
The concern seems to be that this round there's different people around him, right? And that not the same kind of safeguards that there were the last time.
Right.
And that Bessette is the one that the markets apparently trust the most. But you have three different voices coming at him, and besides the one in his own head, right? And they're very disparate. And so, you know, who do you believe, right? And who does he follow?
Lena writes and says, what great points your panelists are making. My own deepest concern for the future of our country, economic and otherwise, is the sheer cruelty and senselessness of Trump and his closest advisors. There's no way to anticipate any stability this way. I think that there may be a limited number of people who want stability, right? I mean, that's the thing of actually who's rooting for stability.
You mean, well, in the administration or
yes,
outside?
Yeah.
Well, they're creating chaos, but the business community wants stability. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you know, so much. Think about all of the energy and resources, financial resources, others that's going into these attacks on universities, right? And these legal attacks, or on law firms, or on now nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just. At the same time, when we're moving into, it looks like, some really serious economically challenging times, their resources are being, distracted, deployed to try to fight for their own survival. It's really discouraging. Can we go back to the person who says, what I do because of, you know, how do I talk to the MAGA people?
Yes.
Because I don't know the real answer to that, but that really requires a lot of thought and attention. And part of it is, how can everybody, you know, shut off some of the noise and just start talking to each other again and figuring out a way? Because we do need to, I mean, it sounds Pollyannish, and I don't know the root, but we need to start having conversations again amongst people who have different views, and you'd be able to disagree without being disagreeable.
May I weigh in on that?
Please.
As an educator, it's, and again, teaching in an environment that is so politically diverse, I find the only way to get students to communicate across the board is by focusing on the institutions. What institutions do we have? Why do we have them? What are their objectives? Are they still working for us? If they're not working for us, what are the alternatives? So to actually understand how the system works provides a basis for communication. Right now, very few people, you asked me at the beginning, Joe, whether I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful about the enthusiasm that is out there, but I am troubled about the lack of understanding of the institutions, how they work.
You know, and I think there's another element to it. We have to take a break, but there's another element to it that was in that letter, which was about talking to family.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's one thing to talk to your students, but another thing to talk to people in
your
community.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah.
But sitting down at the dining room table and talking about those issues, or, God forbid, a long car ride. All right, we'll take a break.
He said from experience, it looks like.
We'll take a break. We'll return. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We're going to take a break with a couple of announcements and then news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Teresa Bourgeois is with us, public policy and communications expert. Jay Jochnowitz, editor-at-large, columnist and editorial writer at the Times Union, and associate professor of government at Dutchess Community College and president of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. Dr. Karen Riedel joins us as well. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Latest in the news about the Pete Hegseth signal chat comes to us from the New York Times. Now, remember, there was the first signal controversy, which is that there was the sharing of this information with the top people, with security experts or security officials. And there was a sharing of that, which also happened to include a journalist from The Atlantic magazine. Over the weekend, the New York Times reported that separate from that, Pete Hegseth had established his own call, and that was on a private telephone and included his brother, it included his wife, and it included his lawyer.
Private lawyer.
Then the question became, or well, the issue became what it had been prior, which is Hegseth and Trump, Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump, both saying that the information that was shared was not confidential, and was something that could be shared freely. Now, it is being reported from Helene Cooper at the New York Times. Details about American strikes in Yemen that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth shared on a commercial chat app came from U.S. Central Command through a secure government system designed for sending classified information, according to an official and a person familiar with the conversations. The chats last month on the Signal app contain the times and sequencing for the launches of American fighter jets. A journalist, as well as Mr. Hegseth's wife, brother, and personal lawyer, were included in those chats. So The Atlantic reported more than a month ago that its editor had been inadvertently included in one Signal chat group about the strikes. On Sunday, as I said, the Times reported that the defense secretary also revealed information about Yemen in a second group chat. Mr. Hegseth has not acknowledged any wrongdoing. But all along, it was being said that there was no classified or confidential information that was being shared. And yet the information, the way that Hegseth got the information, was from a source that had labeled it as classified and confidential. Senator Roger Wicker, a Mississippi Republican who chairs the Armed Services Committee, and the committee's senior Democrat, Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, requested a review. In a letter last month, the senators asked the inspector general to conduct an inquiry. And that is going on. In an appearance on Fox News on Tuesday, Mr. Hegseth continued to press a semantic argument. I said repeatedly, nobody is texting war plans. What was shared over Signal then and now, however you characterize it, was informal. It was unclassified coordinations for media coordinations and other things. He accused his own staff members, whom he had brought to the Defense Department, but then fired last week, of leaking news of the chats, saying they were angry about being let go. Once a leaker, always a leaker, often a leaker, Mr. Hegseth said, appearing on Fox from the Pentagon briefing room.
I can get started on this one because I have mixed feelings. And the mixed feelings are as such. I don't agree with anything that Mr. Hegseth stands for. My outlook, my perspectives on international politics in particular are very different to his. And I wouldn't shed a tear if he resigned or if he were fired. But I want to remove myself from my own personal perspectives, policy perspectives, and I feel especially in this volatile geopolitical dynamic that we're in, first and foremost, I want a State Department that is solid, well-funded, and fully supported by the administration to ensure that America's soft power remains in place, but I also want true leadership in the Department of Defense. And that is what's lacking. Mistakes have been made. We knew that he didn't have the experience or the competence to run the organization. The Senate approved him anyway. He made mistakes. If he stood up there and lived up to the responsibility he carries, whether it is his fault directly or one of his staff members who is responsible for the mess up, he as the leader needs to stand up and take responsibility, and that is not what I'm seeing, and that is my true concern for an organization that is so inherently important to the nation's stability and security.
Sure. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. This is an administration that doesn't seem to really understand the balance between hard power and soft power. And it's just gutting the State Department right and left. Now they're talking about a wholesale reorganization of the State Department. But to go back to Hegseth, I made an observation the other day, and the more I see the tapes, see the video of both Hegseth, I think there's a third person here, but Hegseth and Caroline Leavitt in particular. I said that I would love to play poker with these people because their tells are so bad.
Oh, my goodness.
Every time.
You are so right.
Every time they're lying, their lips start to curl because it's like, oh, I just remembered the thing that everybody told me to say. And I'm going to say warfighters, too, because that's a magical term that makes us all sound like we know what we're talking about. He keeps going from one. He's just grasping at straws right and left. And one of the things he's grasping now is that this isn't new because has to do with the same thing that was talked about a couple of weeks ago. And he knows journalism as well as anyone else. The story builds over time the more you learn about it. So the fact that we knew that a month ago they let an Atlantic reporter, an Atlantic editor into a Signal chat is that was a story. It's also more of a story or an addition to that story that he let family members into another Signal chat that talked about the same thing. And for him to try to blow all this off, which I think is what Trump wants to do as well, as it's old news. It ain't old news. What's scary about this, terrifying about it, and it ought to be, I don't know about terrifying. I don't know that I'm losing sleep at night over it, but I am concerned about it, that this is a moment when our adversaries are looking at this and seeing a very weak defense department with well-known internal turmoil in the upper echelons. And what's scary here is that I don't think we're going to get attacked, But I think that this is a moment when China would say, yeah, this might be a good time to take Taiwan back. You know, or Russia might say, this is a good time to launch an all-out offensive on Ukraine. And maybe go as far as Poland. Who knows? And we haven't heard from South Korea and North Korea in ages. And I'm sure they're feeling left out. I mean, it's just so I would not shed a tear. I would celebrate if Hegseth went back to Fox News, if they would take him back.
Teresa.
Yeah, I think that it's so important to think through what the implications are of this. And I think just a sort of a leadership question, which is it's pretty hard for Trump to come down on Hegseth for misuse of classified information, given his history, right? It's that's going to be a tough thing to do, and that he was all in on him, and that he really strong-armed the Senate to be all in on him, and who else would they get confirmed, although they appear to be beginning to try to figure out who that would be. But the reverse side of that is, how do you discipline anyone else within the ranks for misuse of classified information if you're not disciplining him, right? And so what signal does that send? Either there's a lack of fairness or a lack of discipline around classified information. One of the two is going to happen, and both are dangerous. Mm. And I just think that this has such potentially dangerous repercussions, because for our allies, they're nervous that we can't handle classified information, so they'll withhold it. And concerned about a whole range of constraints that have been around classified information and support systems and such that have been defunded. And separately, our enemies, you know, this says to them, just time to look and listen, because they're not being diligent about it. Mm. And so I think that this has, you know, life-threatening. And Hegseth says he's all about the troops, right? He's all about the troops, the frontline troops. Well, this puts the troops in danger. Yeah. And so then the question is, what are the House and Senate Republicans going to do about it? So as you said, Senator Roger Wicker, Mississippi Republican, he chairs Armed Services, along with Senator Jack Reed, his Democratic counterpart, they requested a review a month ago. So when are the hearings? When is there a public discussion of this? Because if Trump's really, because of his classified information, you know, just think boxes in the bathroom, right? That whole situation there. If he has no standing in this.
For just a moment, just think visualize about boxes in the bathroom.
I mean, a president of the United States, and on the stage, and all on the floor, and he got those back. He demanded to get those boxes
back. Yes.
And then, just as an aside, decimated the archives. Right. All those people, he went in and for two reasons. One, he was worried, you know, upset about the way they handled classified documents, and also because they're the ones who do the anyway. So let's stick with this, though. So if he says he's all for the troops and the frontline troops, how is this being all for the troops and the frontline troops? And how protected do they feel?
Well, he's going to argue that all this is political nonsense, and he's being distracted from, it's pulling him away from his work in strengthening and supporting the warfighters.
But that's not true.
No, it's not. This is all problems of his own making. And to go back to the Mar-a-Lago document thing.
In the bathroom.
Part of what
I can't get over it.
The problem with that was that Trump wasn't just hoarding this material for whatever reasons he was doing it, but he was showing it off to people. And I think that's what Hegseth was doing here, that he was showing it off to his relatives.
And
he was showing it off to his boys.
This is the information that I have. But I seem, and this is no disrespect to the panelists, but to me, the whole point of this take on it, this latest twist, is that the information came from a classified source. It was important enough for it to be deemed classified And while we had these, what I would term to be ridiculous discussions as to whether times of bombings was classified, this seems to prove that if it was on this classified server, that then that's the information. So
he moved the information from a classified communications device,
right,
to a
private cell phone.
That in itself is disqualifying. You don't do that. He didn't need to be told. It was if you don't know this is wrong, you should not be Secretary of Defense. But the problem is, so what's going to happen? And what are the implications? What's going to happen next?
They're going to try to brush all that off as saying the Secretary of Defense can declassify anything he wants. And so, that has been part of their argument.
But
I'd like declassified until
anybody who's listening who's a military person, active military or veteran right now, what would happen if you did this? Because that's when on the news they keep saying to people, well, what would you do? They asked Senator Kelly, what would happen if you did? I'd be court-martialed.
Mark Kelly. Of Arizona. Now, let me ask you this, because the other part of this story is just the overall chaos within the Pentagon, within his office. Let us not forget, we will forget for a moment the inner offices of the Pentagon, but would you just within his core, that is absolute chaos, and to the point where all of those people who were his key advisors are gone.
Yep.
And now what does that mean? And because there really is no, again, this goes back to what you said at the very beginning of our program, when we were talking about a completely different topic. It's just absolute chaos.
And I think it's telling. I may be wanting to read more into it than it is, but I think it's telling that the interview he did with Fox News was him in the briefing room. It's like he's losing people around him, and he may be the last man standing in an inner circle unless he keeps finding more people from Fox News or Breitbart or Newsmax or whoever he thinks is competent enough to be part of his inner circle or loyal enough is what he's looking for at this point. What I see is an increasingly combative and possibly paranoid individual. I'm not a psychiatrist, and I don't play one on the radio. Trump's got to cut him loose, and I think it's going to happen soon. I think.
And these people, to be clear, one of the things that was discussed is if you bring in somebody like him who, is very loyal to the president, but not a lot of experience, so then what you have to do is surround him with people who have a deep understanding of how the Pentagon works.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did not do that, but he surrounded himself with people who were loyal to him. But just by the reports that I read in the Military Times and some other publications, that there was a lot of infighting because they were jockeying for control, because he's not doing the day-to-day, so they were, and it became a toxic situation, and they're all gone now. The people who are gone are not people who had been there before, but people who he brought in. And again, all part of we have a lot going on in the world right now, all over the map. There's a lot of tensions. There's a lot of places that could erupt at any time. And so this kind of instability in the Defense Department was not unanticipated, but that doesn't make it any less dangerous.
Yeah, and it's a serious department to have instability. And it's one thing for I'm just trying to think of some of the stranger people we've had in government over my lifetime. Edward Coop, I think, was one of them. It was one thing to have
the Surgeon General, but he turned out to be okay,
He was okay. For a while, he was a little strange.
I know, but he emerged like he did some good stuff.
Wasn't it James Watts in the...
Now he did not turn out to be okay at EPA.
Yeah.
He was...
From the Interior Department.
Interior
Department under Reagan.
There's these isolated cases. We don't expect people to be perfect. Every once in a while, presidents make a bad choice, but... people losing their purses with
their Gucci
Homeland
purses.
Security director losing her purse at a restaurant, having it lifted apparently.
Quite artfully, was described.
Two quick stories of absolutely no importance whatsoever. But one is the political comedian Mark Russell.
I loved Mark Russell.
He had a great line years ago that said that James Watt's idea of a wilderness area was a parking lot without lines. I like that. My father, in his 35-year career in the federal government and working with then HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, was at a dinner, and he sat next to Surgeon General Coop's wife, who kept on referring to him as Chick. And my father said, "Oh, Chick, why would you call him Chick?" And she said, "For God's sakes, his last name is Coop." And we laughed. We have a couple of letters before we go to a break. Philip says, "Why does Pete Hegseth continue his sloppy handling of sensitive material? A conjecture: by sharing it with people who have no right or reason to see it. He cultivates his aura of power. Look, what I know and what I can share when I choose to. The deeper issue is that for Trump and his cronies, nothing is really important other than their own narrow self-interest. Certainly classified information is not important and so does not deserve to be safeguarded." Then we go to this letter from Susan. I think it was Teresa who said, "Imagine if Joe Biden had changed his position or said these things. I'm paraphrasing. He'd have been crucified. Perhaps this is because the first folks to question and express doubt would have been his own party. If the Democrats are to regain the presidency, we need to get better at coming up with a message that we can get behind and repeat." Then,
in fairness to the Democrats, I've been listening to some of the congressional hearings and stuff. They're being quite forceful. It's just for some reason not getting out there in the rest of the world. Within the hearings, I mean, I watched Marjorie Taylor Greene try to gavel a senator into silence a House member into silence the other day. And you see this time and again. But for some reason, it's just
the media is not covering it.
Well, partly because you have a president who knows how to command a news cycle. With one disaster after another, or one outrageous comment after another.
Which is unfortunate, because they are really getting to the issues of what matters to people on their kitchen table, and they're doing it not only in these hearings in Washington, but they're doing it in events around the country. And if you're a C-SPAN watcher, like only like five of us are, you see that. But
We love you for it, though.
I know, we really do.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and finish up right after this break. All right. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. And there's a lot to talk about. I mean, obviously, I do think as we talk about this, Jerome Powell saying he's not going to be fired, and Trump has no intention of firing Powell, and yet he also apparently has no intent of firing Hegseth. So those are interesting parallel stories.
He's 100% behind him until he isn't.
That's right. That seems to be the going
his way
wisdom.
To go.
So let's talk about Elon Musk for a while, shall we? This I find also to be an interesting story because I don't know what it means. Billionaire Elon Musk says he will step back from the U.S. Doge service next month and focus on Tesla, his reeling electric vehicle company, which on Tuesday reported a stunning 71% plunge in profits compared with the first quarter of 2024, with Tesla suffering amid widespread backlash against Musk's controversial work with the Trump administration. Musk told investors that his time allocations to Doge will drop significantly starting next month, though he said he probably will maintain involvement with DOGE through the remainder of President Donald Trump's term. On Tuesday, the electric vehicle company reported a 9% decline in revenue for the first 3 months of the year compared with a year earlier, according to a company report. Sales also dipped dramatically in the first 3 months of the year, falling 13% compared with the same period last year. So what makes this interesting is that there are a couple of contradictory reports or contradicting reports. One being that he said that he will continue and only work a day or two a week. That was another statement that came out later. Also, that the White House saying that the work of DOGE was almost done. They were almost done doing whatever it is they were doing.
As I mentioned earlier, this is the diminishing expectations with DOGE have been extraordinary. You know, there are people that I think the saying going around for a while was the cruelty is the point. It referred to both the deportation controversy as well as I think the internal controversy in government. There is a huge movement out there. The MAGA movement, I think, was very happy, and I think the conservative movement in general was very happy to see not just government being dismantled, but being dismantled painfully and retributively. Retributively? It was just, a lot of cruelty, a lot of turmoil. But the bottom line is, what has he accomplished? You know, we started at, as I pointed out before, $2 trillion. We went down to $2.2 billion, and now it's actually more like $200 million. And we're going to take about half of that and give the president a parade anyway for his birthday,
oh my God.
Supposedly. I get that Elon Musk wants to try to fix Tesla. The question is whether, if he gets out of it enough, will the protests stop? Will the Molotov cocktails stop? Will all the the attacks on Tesla stop? I saw a I won't call it the name that people call it. I saw a Tesla truck yesterday, and I get that people are turning them in. First of all, they're ugly. That's my opinion. But it's also, can you imagine driving around in a truck that everybody, so many people are just staring at you and hating you for doing it, having a vehicle. And now...
But people drive jet skis.
And now there's this new controversy that is probably even more serious than anything. I think it's more serious than anything going on. This new report that Tesla may have been speeding up the odometers to avoid warranty repairs, dramatically speeding them up. It's probably illegal, but as a sales tactic, as an image builder, this is not it. To think that your company, your car company, is cheating you, actively cheating you on its obligations. So he's got a lot of repairing to do. And if he says he's going to keep a little hand in DOGE, this isn't going to fix his problems.
Karen.
It raises so many questions. I have so many questions about this. First, I mean, I actually wonder how much of Musk's wealth is invested in and comes from SpaceX. And I don't have an answer for that. I tried to get an answer for that. Secondly, I wonder to what degree Musk stepping back from the limelight is actually in the interest, of course, of the administration. He's becoming less and less popular among the MAGA folks. He spoke out openly against tariffs. Pulling him out of the limelight, it may be very much in the interest of the administration. It doesn't necessarily mean he's not going to be heavily involved. He doesn't have to be there in person to be heavily involved. And DOGE still exists. Is there any plan of ever dismantling this organization? We still have, what was his name, Big Balls, the 18-year-old? There are so many questions. I don't know what it means for Clearly, Tesla is in trouble, right? And it's and clearly it has to do with Musk's involvement in politics, but it also has to do with the fact that the Cybertruck, which again my 11-year-old loves, is just not an attractive car, right? It's like so that's another reason, and
it's
all
this
the competition,
generation's DeLorean.
DeLorean, yeah. But the DeLorean, at least, I kind of liked DeLoreans back then. You know, the wing, the wings were cool.
Yeah,
that was
cool.
Definitely cool. But and the fact that it could go back into the past. That.
But does it mean that his influence is waning? I don't know. Trump needs his money, and so I think the influence, his influence, will be exactly what he wants it to be. But we may just not be. It may not be as transparent anymore, right?
Which is concerning in and of itself, right? Teresa.
So I just want to say for the record that I think that the protests against Tesla should absolutely not contain any sort of violence. I just think that that's reprehensible. And I just think that that doesn't help anybody's cause, and it's revolting. But my concerns more about Musk, as I understand it, his title or his he can be doing what he's doing because he has this special he's in a special category which allows him to do what he's doing for 180 days. That's his appointment, 180 days. So I gather it's not calendar days, it's days that he's there. So one of the speculation is that if he's there fewer days a week, then it increases the number of weeks he can be there. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I read last night. I'm more concerned not about what's happening to Tesla, but what's happening to Musk operations that have inserted themselves in the U.S. operations, whether it's Starlink at FAA or, you know, any of a host of things that have reported to happen. And I think that, you know, he was under investigation by USAID, and he successfully dismantled the most of USAID. He's under investigation by the FAA, and he ousted their key people. And all across the board, he has had an impact on our government and accessed our government information. And so I think we need to have a much deeper understanding of what the implications of that. Where are the no-bid contracts where he, you know, inserted some of their work in the White House operations or across any agency? I think somebody really needs to investigate that. And whatever happens to Tesla, so be it. I'm more concerned about how he has inserted his company and his people, because that's the other thing. Remember, if he leaves, he has still inserted his people in key places, as has Peter Thiel. I mean, we don't talk about Peter Thiel, but HHS, other places, you know, they have inserted people within the bureaucracies. And what are the implications of that? That's what I'm worried about.
A couple of letters before we break this morning. This one from Lawrence. The first three words of the Constitution are, "We the people." Adherence to the Constitution depends on us, the people, but we are now sheep. We are doing whatever one scary dog wants us to do.
Well, I think that a lot of people are more and more frequently speaking out, which I think is terrific, all over the country. I mean, I watched a short bit of Rachel Maddow the other night, and in Alaska, in these cities all over Alaska, I mean, all over the country, people are beginning to organize and speak out, and we need a lot more of that.
And the intransigence in the MAGA movement, I think you just have to accept that that is not going to change.
It doesn't matter. It's everybody else that matters.
Yeah. And this country is always, elections are always going to be decided, barring a major, major disaster. They're always going to be decided, it seems, on the margins.
And where are the Republicans in the House and Senate? At what point do they speak up?
Bill writes, "My friends, this is who America is. When was it great? It was founded on genocide. It was built on slavery. And Americans elected this guy." It's a very grim way to end the
show. Let's end the show talking about the Pope.
Okay, go ahead. We have 1 minute. Go ahead.
I just want to remember the moment in 2015 where the Pope came to the United States, spoke before the Congress, and then there was supposed to be a formal luncheon after. And instead of going to that luncheon, he said, no, I'm sorry, I have I'm otherwise engagement. And he went and had lunch with a group of homeless people and a group of people from the Catholic Charities who work there. Among them was my cousin, Sister Bernadette Longton, who had been working among the poor in D.C. for her whole lifetime until she recently died. But that was such a powerful and amazing event. And I think that really tells a lot about who he is. So I just wanted to take a moment to say how amazing the Pope is. And I hope the next one follows in his footsteps, and that those who go to mourn him, not just go mourn him, but maybe model his behavior.
Okay, now that's the way we should end the show. You win.
Thank you.
So we won't end with Sarah Palin.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, okay. Wanted to go to Sarah Palin, but oh well. We're out of time. My apologies. Thanks to everybody for being with us. Jay, Karen, Teresa, I appreciate you all and for being here this morning and sharing your insights. We'll continue our program right after this short bit.